Part 2. Chimera. Chapter 14. June 4th, 2007. Gyeongdo Island, South Korea. At 55 meters in length, the steel-hulled Benetti yacht was impressive even by Monte Carlo affluent standards. The custom-built Italian yacht's lush interior featured an array of marble flooring, Persian carpets, and rare Chinese antiques, which filled the cabins and salons with warm elegance. A collection of 15th-century oil paintings by the Flemish master Hans Memling dotted the walls, adding to the eclectic feel. The glistening maroon and white exterior, which featured a wide band of wraparound dark-tinted windows, was given a more traditional appearance, with inlaid teak decking and brass fittings on the outside verandas. The entire effect was a tasteful mix of old-world charm combined with the speed and function of modern design and technology. Always turning heads as it roared by, the vessel was an admired fixture on the Han River in and about Seoul. To the local society crowd, an invitation aboard was a highly desired mark of prominence, providing the rare opportunity to mingle with the boat's enigmatic owner. Daejeong Kang was a leading icon of South Korean industry and seemed to have his hands in everything. Little was known of the mercurial leader's early background, aside from his sudden appearance during the economic boom of the 1990s as the head of a regional construction company. But upon taking over the reins, the low-tech firm became a corporate Pac-Man, gobbling up companies in the shipping, electronics, semiconductors, and telecommunications industries in a series of leveraged buyouts and hostile takeovers. The businesses were all rolled under the umbrella of Kang Enterprises, a privately held empire entirely controlled and directed by Kang himself. Unafraid of the public spotlight, Kang mixed freely with politicians and business leaders alike, wielding additional influence on the board of directors of South Korea's largest companies. The 50-year-old bachelor held a veil of mystery over his private life, however. Much of his time was spent sequestered at his large estate on a secluded section of Gyeongdo Island, a lush mountainous outpost near the mouth of the Han River on the western Korean coast. There he dabbled with a stable of Austrian show horses or worked on his golf game, according to the few that had been invited inside the private enclave. More carefully hidden was a dark secret about the iconoclastic businessman that would have completely shocked his corporate cronies and political patrons. Unknown to even his closest associates, Kang had operated for over 25 years as a sleeper agent for the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or North Korea, as it was known by the rest of the world. Kang was born in the Hwanghae province of North Korea shortly after the Korean War. At the age of 3, his parents were killed in a railroad derailment blamed on South Korean insurgents, and the infant boy was adopted by his maternal uncle. The uncle, a founding member of the Korean Workers' Party in 1945, had fought with Kim Il-sung and his anti-Japanese guerrilla forces based in the Soviet Union during World War II. When Kim Il-sung later rose to power in North Korea, the uncle was richly rewarded with a series of provincial government appointments, brokering himself into ever more spheres of influence until ultimately gaining a seat as an elite ruling member of the Central People's Committee, the top executive decision-making organization in North Korea. During his uncle's ascension, Kang received a thorough indoctrination in the Korean Workers' Party dogma while obtaining the best state-sponsored education the fledgling country could offer. Recognized early as a fast learner who excelled at his studies, Kang was groomed as a foreign operative with sponsorship from his uncle. Blessed with a keen financial mind, command-like leadership skills, and a ruthless heart, Kang was smuggled into South Korea at the age of 22 and set up as a laborer at a small construction company. With brutal efficiency, he quickly worked his way up to foreman, then arranged a series of accidental worksite deaths that killed the firm's president and top managers. Forging a series of ownership transfer documents, Kang quickly took control of the business within 2 years of his arrival. With secret direction and capital infusion from Pyongyang, the young communist entrepreneur slowly expanded his network of commercial enterprises over the years, focusing on products and services most beneficial to the North. Kang's forays into telecommunications provided access to Western network communications hardware valuable to the military's command and control systems. His semiconductor plants secretly built chips for use in short-range missiles. And his fleet of cargo ships provided the means for covertly transferring defense technology to the government of his homeland. The profits from his corporate empire, which were not smuggled north in the form of Western goods and technology, were spent bribing key politicians for government contracts or utilized for the hostile acquisition of other companies. Yet Kang's zealous appropriation of power and technology was almost peripheral to his primary objective, set forth by his handlers so many years before. Kang's mission, in the simplest of provisions, was to promote the reunification of the two Korean countries, but on North Korea's terms. The sleek Benetti yacht slowed its engines as it entered a narrow inlet off the Han River that wound snake-like into a protected cove. As the boat eased through the inlet, the pilot increased the throttle again, racing the boat smoothly across the calm waters of the interior lagoon. A yellow floating dock bobbed gently on the opposite side of the cove, which quickly grew larger in size as the yacht drew near. The big vessel stormed towards the dock, swinging parallel at just the last minute as its engines were cut. A pair of black uniformed men grabbed the bow and stern lines and tied off the vessel as the pilot finessed her the last few feet to the dock. The shore crew quickly rolled a stepped platform against the yacht's side, the upper step matching the foot level of the first deck. A cabin door popped open, and three gray-looking men in dark blue suits stepped down onto the dock and instinctively peered up at the large stone structure perched above them. Jutting from a cliff that rose nearly vertically above the dock nestled an immense stone house that was half-carved into the crown of the bluff. Thick walls surrounded the house, lending a medieval look to the compound, although the house itself was clearly of Asian design, with a deep, angular tiled roof capping the brownstone walls. The entire structure sat 200 feet above the water, accessible by a steep set of stairs carved into the rock on one side. The three men noted that 12-foot-high stone walls ran all the way down to the water's edge, ensuring a high degree of privacy. A tight-lipped guard standing at the dock's footing with an automatic rifle slung over his shoulder ensured even more. As the men in suits made their way along the dock, a door opened from a small structure near the landing, and out walked their host to greet them. There was no question that Daejeong Kang had an imposing air about him. At an even 6 feet tall and weighing 200 pounds, his physical mass was large by Korean standards. But it was his stern face and penetrating eyes that indicated a willful presence. Under the right circumstances, his piercing glare could almost cut a man in two. A practiced but insincere smile helped break down barriers when he needed to, but an icy cold aloofness always lingered over him like a cloud. He was a man who reeked of power and was not afraid to use it. "Welcome, gentlemen," Kang said in a smooth voice. "I trust your voyage from Seoul was enjoyable." The three men, all leading party members in the South Korean National Assembly, nodded in unison. The senior member of the political trio, a balding man named Yongnok Ri, replied for the group. "A trip down the Han River is a delight in such a beautiful boat." "It is my preferred means of commuting to Seoul," Kang replied, implying the boredom he found flying in his private helicopter. "Right this way," he motioned towards the small building at the base of the cliff. The politicians followed him obediently past a small security station and down a narrow passageway to a waiting elevator, the shaft of which had been carved directly into the cliff. The visitors admired an ancient painting of a tiger hung on the elevator's back wall as it rose rapidly to the main house. When the doors opened, the men stepped out into an expansive, ornately decorated dining room. Beyond an elegant mahogany dining table, floor-to-ceiling glass walls offered a breathtaking view of the Han River Delta, where the Grand River's waters emptied into the Yellow Sea. A sprinkling of worn sampans and small cargo boats dotted the horizon, fighting their way upriver towards Seoul with a supply of trade goods. Most of the boats clung to the south bank of the river, well away from the imaginary demarcation line with North Korea that ran down the river center. "An incredible view, Mr. Kang," offered the tallest of the three politicians, a man named Won Ho. "I enjoy it, for the vista encompasses both our countries," Kang replied with intent. "Please be seated." He waved a hand as he spoke, then took a seat at the head of the table. A cadre of uniformed servants began shuttling in an array of fine wines and gourmet dishes, while the conversation amongst the seated men drifted towards politics. A medley of spicy fragrances filled the air as they dined on daiji bulgogi, or pork marinated in a spicy garlic sauce, accompanied by yachai gui, an assortment of marinated vegetables. Kang played the gregarious host to his guests until they had comfortably imbibed, then he applied the knife. "Gentlemen, it's high time we take seriously the effort to unify our two countries," he spoke slowly, for effect. "As a Korean, I know that we are one country in language, in culture, and in heart. As a businessman, I know how much stronger we could be economically in the global markets. The Sino-American threat, which has long justified the use of our countries as pawns to the superpowers, is no more. It is long past time that we throw off the shackles of foreign domination and do what is right for Korea. Our destiny is as one, and we should seize the opportunity now." "The goal of unification beats strongly in all our hearts, but the reckless leadership and military juggernaut of North Korea mandates that we tread with caution," replied the third politician, a beady-eyed man named Kim. Kang brushed aside the comment. "As you know, I recently toured North Korea as part of a fact-finding trip sponsored by the Ministry of Unification. We found their economy to be in a moribund state, with food shortages widespread and rampant. The depleted economic state has taken a toll on the North Korean military as well. The military forces we witnessed appeared ill-equipped and extremely low in morale," he lied. "Yes, I can attest to their struggles," Won Ho replied. "But do you really think reunification would be a benefit to our own economy? The northern provinces offer an abundance of cheap labor that is readily accessible. We would immediately become more competitive on the world markets, as our average labor costs would diminish substantially. I have assessed the impact to my own enterprises, and make no secret of the fact that my profits could be boosted dramatically. In addition, the northern province economies would provide a new, untapped consumption market that South Korean business is poised to serve. No, gentlemen, there is no question that unification would provide an economic windfall to all of us in the South. There is still the issue of North Korea's hard-line contention in the matter," Won Ho stated. "We cannot simply achieve reunification unilaterally." "Yes," Kim added. "They have repeatedly insisted that the United States military presence be removed from our soil before reunification can be considered." "That is why," Kang continued calmly, "I am asking the three of you to support the resolution recently introduced in the National Assembly, demanding the removal of all American military forces from South Korea." A stunned silence fell over the room as the three politicians digested Kang's words. Kang had brought them there for a reason, they knew, but the politicians had figured the corporate giant was seeking legislative tax relief or some other aid to his business empire. Not one of them expected a demand so risky to their political careers. The elder statesman Ree finally cleared his throat and spoke deliberately. "That particular resolution was introduced by radical elements in the assembly. there is little chance it would ever pass a full vote.
There is if the three of you came on record in support of it,
Kang replied.
That's impossible, Kim stammered. I cannot support weakening our military defense for the asking, while North Korea continues to consign all its resources towards boosting its military might.
You can, and you will.
With the recent murder of the girl in Kungsan City by the American serviceman, there is a firestorm of animosity towards the American military from the mainstream populace. It is incumbent upon you to place pressure on our president to act, and act now.
But the American forces are essential for our security. There are over 35,000 troops stationed in our defense,
Kim argued before being cut off.
May I remind you,
Kang hissed, his face contorting into an evil smirk,
that I have paid and negotiated your way into the position that you hold today.
The controlled rage glowed from his eyes like burning embers. Ri and Won Ho slumped back in their chairs and nodded gravely, knowing their political futures were finished if knowledge of their graft over the years was ever released to the press.
Yes, it will be done,
Won Ho said meekly. Kim, however, appeared oblivious to Kang's rage. Shaking his head, he replied firmly,
I'm sorry, but I cannot support placing our country at risk of military defeat. I will not vote in favor of the resolution.
He turned and peered at his fellow politicians with a look of scorn. The room fell silent again for several moments before the servants returned to clear away the dinner dishes. Kang leaned over and whispered something into the ear of one of the servants, who quickly paced back to the kitchen. Seconds later, a side door opened, and two hulking security guards, attired in black from head to toe, entered the room. Without saying a word, they strode to either side of Kim's chair, grabbed his arms, and yanked the politician roughly to his feet.
What is the meaning of this, Kang? He cried.
I will suffer your foolishness no more,
Kang replied coldly. With a wave of his hand, the two thugs muscled Kim to a veranda door that opened onto an outside balcony. Flailing and struggling hopelessly against the stronger men, Kim was dragged outside and to the edge of the balcony wall, which jutted over the face of the rock cliff. Obscenities burst from his mouth as he demanded to be let go, but his pleas were ignored. As Ri and Won Ho looked on in horror, the two men in black hoisted Kim up off his feet, then unceremoniously pitched his thrashing body over the wall. Kim's screaming voice could be heard trailing away for several seconds as he plunged down the cliff wall. A faint thud signaled that his body had struck the beach landing below, and his screaming suddenly ceased. Ri and Won Ho turned ashen white as the two thugs calmly returned to the dining hall. Kang sipped at a glass of wine, then spoke to the security man in a nonchalant tone.
Retrieve the body and take it to Seoul. Plant him on a street near his residence and make it look like a hit-and-run traffic accident, he ordered.
As they left the room, Kang turned to the frightened politicians and asked with icy politeness,
You will stay for dessert, won't you?
Kang peered out the dining hall window and watched as Ri and Won Ho anxiously boarded his yacht below. Kim's body, wrapped in a brown blanket, had been crudely dumped on the boat's stern deck and covered with a tarp, but was readily distinguishable to the two shaken men as they climbed aboard. Observing the yacht as it cast off and began its 50-mile trek upriver to Seoul, Kang turned as a man entered the room and approached. He had a scrawny build and greased back black hair, with pale skin that seldom saw the light of day. His blue suit was well worn and his choice of tie dated, but his white shirt was starched crisp. What Kang's administrative assistant lacked in panache, he made up for in thrift and efficiency.
Your meeting was a success,
the man asked Kang with a dose of subservience.
Yes, Quan.
Ri and Won Ho are going to promote our initiative for the removal of U.S. forces through the National Assembly.
It was unfortunate that we had to eliminate Kim, but it was apparent that he had lost his loyalty to us. His death will send a strong message to the other two.
A sensible decision.
Sir, a courier from Yonan is arriving by boat this evening to receive the prototype missile guidance chipset that has passed final test at our semiconductor facility. Do you wish also to relay a briefing status? Like a foreign embassy in a hostile nation, Kang and his superiors in North Korea relied on couriers to funnel information, technology, and contraband out of the South. Although the Internet had become the spy's best friend when it came to dispatching information, there was still the need for one-on-one contact to transfer hard goods. An aged fisherman in a beat-up sampan, easily neglected by the Navy patrols, was the favored agent's disguise for crossing the DMZ to Kang's estate.
Yes. We can report that a National Assembly vote will be brought forth on the expulsion resolution within the next several weeks, and that progress is being made on its passage. Our organized student protests are gaining momentum, and our media payoffs will ensure continued press attention and coverage of the U.S. serviceman murder incident, Kang said with a wry smile. Our external disruption plan is proving to be most effective. What remains to be seen is whether we can implement the Chimera project quickly enough to maximize the Americans' strife.
What is the latest from the biochemical laboratory?
The news is most promising. The lab team has completed their study of the test results from the Aleutian Islands and verified that the virus was successfully rejuvenated during flight release. In addition, dispersion of the virus through the mock-up missile-borne vapor mechanism covered a ground path larger than anticipated. The program engineers are confident that the full-scale deployment system already built will be operationally successful.
Providing we can generate sufficient quantities of the virus. It was most unfortunate that all but one of the canisters on the I-403 submarine was destroyed.
An unforeseen circumstance. Since most of the recovered agent was utilized in the Aleutian test firing, very little was left available for laboratory growth purposes. Dr. Sargov at the biolab informs me it will take over 3 months to cultivate quantities necessitated by the program. For this reason, we have initiated your request to attempt recovery of the second Japanese armament stock.
A second Japanese submarine, Kang muttered, picturing an Imperial Japanese submersible lying torpedoed on the ocean floor. An amazing intelligence discovery that there was not one, but two submarines destroyed carrying such a virulent cargo. How soon before recovery operations commence?
The submarine must be located first. We have the Baikje en route to Yokohama to pick up a leased submersible that will be required for the deep water recovery operation. Once on site, we expect the survey to take approximately 2 days and the entire recovery operation to be completed within 10 days.
And Tongju?
He will meet up with the salvage ship in Yokohama and remain on board to lead security operations.
Very good. Kang said, rubbing his hands together in satisfaction. Things are proceeding nicely, Quan. The domestic pressures on the Americans will soon be very hot, and the Chimera project will be a sharp kick to their sides. We must soon prepare for the coming offensive and restoration of the country under our home flag.
You will hold a place of high honor in the new Korea, Quan stroked.
Kang looked again at the sweeping panorama to the north before him. The rolling hills of his native North Korea lay just across the Han River, stretching wide across the far horizon.
It is time we regain our country, he muttered softly.
Quan started to leave the room, then stopped and turned.
Sir, there is one other item that has cropped up related to the Chimera project.
Kang nodded at his assistant to proceed.
The helicopter that was shot down in the Aleutians was operated by an American government research vessel from the National Underwater and Marine Agency. Our crew believed the pilot and crew were killed, which was initially confirmed by an Alaskan media report of a fatal helicopter crash.
However, our U.S. field operations team monitoring the Americans' response to the test reported that the pilot, a special projects director named Pitt, and his co-pilot had, in fact, survived the crash.
That is of little consequence, Kang replied irritably.
Quan cleared his throat nervously.
Well, sir, I had our team track the pilot upon his return to home port in Seattle. 2 days after their return, the NUMA men were seen in a small survey boat headed for the region where the I-403 is located.
What? That's not possible,
Kang belched with sudden anger, made visible by a large vein that throbbed on his forehead.
How would they have any knowledge of our activities?
I do not understand it either.
They are undersea professionals. Perhaps our recovery operation was witnessed by others, and they were simply monitoring the I-403 for looters. Or perhaps it is just a coincidence. They may have been performing an engineering or archaeological assessment.
Perhaps. But this is no time to compromise the project.
Have them both taken care of, Kang directed.
Yes, sir, Quan replied, backpedaling out of the room quickly. It will be handled at once.